I'd like to introduce now a man like Charles Gunther, who cares more about local young poets and artists than his own work. A former politician, teacher, and also reviewer for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. A ghostwriter, and a man who daydreams fairly well and writes poetry about his daydreams. Peter Simpson.
Hell, I do care more about young poets than I do about my own writing. You've already gotten your money's worth with the songs of the Boyers and Charles' wonderful poems, but I had to keep my teeth in all this time, so I'm going to try to make the time worth the wait. I want to dedicate this reading to my wife, Helen, who has endured marriage. I want to begin by reading a little wedding song I wrote for another couple, but it's for her, too, because everything good I know about marriage, I've learned from her. This is called a promise. A promise don't come cheap. Not polyester, the real thing. It can be counted on. Not by computers, fingers maybe. Has to be rubbed and ridden till it shines. Essentially, it's a saddle. Needs strong shoulders, solid backing. Leather lasts, don't you know? Gets its fine style from our riding. Strangely, promises produce. Won't curl up to mama when it rains. It'd say, Jesus, touching down upon his jackass in Jerusalem, all the mad, wild Irish kings chasing on their nutty hunts. It loves the good old sunshine on every all-too-wrinkled cheek. Once made, it asks a lot, but a lot less than it gives. Kept with luck, it consummates. I want to recall a day from our marriage, and I'm reading this because this is a special night for me. This is the first time I've ever had not only my wife at a reading, but also my daughter, and she's mentioned in this poem. So I thought I'd bring a little red to her face. He's got all the rest of them in there, too. It's called Saturday's a Holiday at Our House. Rest has runs a-thumping any time after 5 a.m. as the kids hit the splintered floor in herds like skittish antelopes on a plain in wild Africa. They're all glad as cartoon cowboys spark the bold heart of Tom. Kate's full of duty, ready to trudge through snow for bacon and tart orange drink. Ed spits a stale highball, coughing as he shakes his fist at our bed. Carrie teases for a crackerjack kiss, curling under blankets. Margaret is free with her toothless smiles in her mother's arms, a tender compass for my felt lips. For a while, I've been extended along the girl who nips my bones and makes me light as a clowning spider. I foresee from my tangled web, today no one will be dying. I'm sleeping in at home this morning. One of the best dividends of being in politics is not the money you can squirrel away in your basement, but the friends you make. And I'm privileged to have with me tonight one of the finest friends I've made, Mr. Ken Billups. And I want to read this poem as a kind of a tribute to him, because for a while on the St. Louis Arts and Humanities Commission, we were culture vultures together. And this is about one of our local institutions. I visited, this recalls a visit I made to the City Art Museum about a couple of weeks after I was rejected for re-election. So there's a little self-contempt in here. But it also remembers what Yeats said at the end of his marvelous poem, The Municipal Gallery Revisited. Think where man's glory most begins and ends, and say my glory was, I had such friends. Skipping Mass, I went instead to feed another hunger in my soul and scrub the clouds across my eyes. Now, 34, some 4 years of a rather public life have found me less and less like Christ. Dead things in stone and steel, in paint and wood, or any stuff the hand, the heart, the tuned self, or any cleft of man might shape, stood, hung, rested in those slick halls designed for public wonder. A few live souls were there, busy at their Sunday morning musing. One of those broads in horn-rimmed glasses, with a clipboard pressed against two thorny tits under her tailored suit, was noting and explaining. Not to me. Though that sharpness in my mind smiled and scorned her, a brutal prayer sprang in my gut, and horns of my own kind began to shine. Oh, come again to womanhood and be in heat beneath the tweed. Well, that call, of course, rang only in the silence of a sudden wish, but it was real enough to start a dream, a dawning in a nice motel with antiseptic walls and pillowcases clean and pillows tight. Her glasses lay upon the floor, on her torn bra, the last to fall. Her will had given up long since, but I was glad to help sustain her pure illusion that the thing we had that night before was rape. For I'd been a soaring swan, like crazy Billy Yates, had blown and sown my own sweet will, and now took gently all the tears that flooded from her troubled sleep. I liked the change I wrought in her. Soon, other human forms destroyed my choices in the dream. A neat Negro father with a hefty wife and daughter led each other into some dark exhibition hall. I wish them well in a liberal way. My feeling for this visit was coming to an end. The time had come to look at my few favorite things. Pan in Italian marble slept hidden round in a corner out of the mainstream of American life, shamed in the sculpture hall. Some enemy, maybe even the girl with the clipboard to her boobs, had done it. Cut his water off, and the fountain of his bed, the crushed rocks around the base, were dry. Thank God he hadn't been put away for good. You can bet that I was proud of loving him, and kindly I looked on the fearful wrenching his sleep put on his face. His goat prick was hard beneath stone cloth for the nymph his throat had gulped at in the woods. She'd been a fairer sorrow than my dream girl, without a doubt. He gave off pure sound, the lonesome, loathsome satyr moaning to the lordly swan who had to care, because they tore the self-same soul. So I went straight to St. Sebastian, tied to the tree and stuck with arrows many men had aimed to murder what he meant. His blood dissolves the thorns from tits and smooths the tweed that rubs the body raw. Told to clean my act and change my style, I ran for fresh air to the statue of Sophocles by an American Irishman. I stood transformed, transfixed, and then drove home to wife and kids in the car in which I came. I'm something of a professional Irishman, and one night I was looking through a magazine called Ireland of the Welcomes, which is an Irish travel magazine, and they had a section of drawings and photographs of Irish wildflowers. So this is a sequence of poems. I'm just going to read two or three of them on various Irish wildflowers. The first one is Sea Pink or Thrift. A chattering clump of girls meeting for lunch downtown among cracked rocks. They wag scornfully as scandal yet delight in their gab waves their little heads proud and high. Will they break if some great thing falls on them in the dark? St. Patrick's cabbage. They are neither food nor fragrance for a modern pope. Thin, contemporary, strung out like veins along burnt-out bones. Your name is big, like us, who see that we must be about the body's business. So we shock old men of God lacking a bland decorum for the dying, and I fear we simply bore the Lord. Wild Columbine. Don't turn your eyes to me. I can't look back. How many have drunk of me and mine, I do not ask myself. Be fair to all your memories and turn your torture from the rack of right and wrong. God's eye looks kindest on those who slip directly into night or fly through clouds. For judging us is not his basic bother, though he will, of course. But how he will devise to do it will make sense only to those who gave their best to love. Read your poem by my grandmother. Imagine her dancing in the coal fields of Glen Carbon, feeling with her feet how hard it was. Later, she simply had no time to gaze at stars, keeping underwear washed, shirts starched and pressed. How her bushes bloomed, how thick her chicken gravy was, how she could keep all feverish things in place. That's a poem for another woman who means a lot to me, Emily Dickinson. One of her most marvelous lines, the wounded deer leaps highest. Her marks are deep and spread like ferns, this very minute being pressed to coal down in the blackest reaches of the planet. Green, thin, these delicate grows fell to their fate of turning some far day into hot fire, long before her eggshell brow beat against its birth in a cold land. Every etch of human pain is prepared like that. I think this poem might try to capture how we all feel sometimes. It's called simply Behind Our Eyes. For so long I've been feeling them, the tears behind my eyes, begging them to start flowing free. A bear in midlife can't make it through the dark with eyes glazed inside out. Dogs smell that kind of salt. Hunters are dying to prove they're tough. They have their steely, well-heeled guides who do not have to dip their hands in blood. Just smile smug when the fallen prey is overturned and they can watch the mucus slipping open now from half-closed lids. Try hard to turn them loose now. I want to read you a couple of poems about my father. There's going to be a little prose introduction to the first one. I was asked to write a comment for a book that's being published in Kansas City on how, in 500 words or less, I work my way through a crisis. So this poem is called Dealing with Death. Well, the piece is called Dealing with Death, and it leads up to a poem. As a boy of 12, I was confronted with the death of my father. The eldest son, I felt close to him personally, though I had not seen him during the last, mostly hospitalized year of his life. Death is the hardest thing we all have to realize, and in my father's case, it took me a long time. For a young Catholic, having a father die on Good Friday and be buried on Easter Monday tangles the event with all the mysteries of redemption and resurrection. A tough fact stared me in the face as I saw him go into the grave the day after the priest had gloried in the rising of Christ. I couldn't absorb irony yet. The year was 1944, and my mind was also filled with movies seen at the Apollo and Pageant theaters, full of sky duels and blasting tanks. There were also a lot of spies, leading me to the conviction that Dad was using death as a cover. He would return a hero after the war was over. Peace came, and he stayed away. Something of him held with me, however. An earlier Lent, when we walked together on chill mornings to St. Rock's Church to Mass and Communion, provided a forceful physical memory. There was a light frost on the sidewalk, which caused the synthetic rubber heels on his shoes to squeal as he walked. That sound became a part of me. At moments, when I faced the lonesome decisions of puberty and adulthood and wanted my father's help and guidance, or just his companionship, all I could hear were his shoes pacing the rimed concrete. They were forceful. Whenever I heard them, I was convinced of his actual presence. The steps were more than just memories. Because I loved him, they always hurt. These experiences were second nature, and I simply did not find them remarkable. I can't say they ever played a crucial role in guiding me one direction or another. I just knew my dad was with me. In this way, he remained with me until my middle 20s. One evening after my marriage, I sat at my desk and reflected. It came to me that the sounds had not asserted themselves for a very long time. I supposed they were gone. It occurred to me that I had finally and fully realized my father's death. I felt very healthy about it. Healed of this wound, I could come to terms with it. This must be emphasized because there's a lot of cheap talk about how poetry can be used for therapeutic purposes. The words of the poem deal with the departure of the sound. I'm trying to show how time and life work things out if we leave ourselves to our evolving devices. The departure was sound, because a mature man should deal with reality more immediately than a child might. That's the way I wrote this poem and the way I hope it will be read, a sound departure. It was Lent, and I was 10. My father's cat's paw heels struck and crashed the sidewalk snow. I heard those squeals until about a year ago. The sounds slept in the brain at normal rest, woke up in real and sudden. ghostly pain. My soft teeth bit the icy wind, but his hand would hold my own. 5 sleepy blocks we walked together through the cold to church. An easy hump of bridge rose up halfway, a rise that helped me gulp a sissy lump and cut my throat to size. We took a middle pew, kept to ourselves. He taught his son to smile and pray. Back home, hot breakfast cooked. He let me run. Sometimes I can't tell cream of wheat from sacramental bread, recalling that brisk, simple Lent. Today, his heels are lead. The night I lost that election, I didn't want my mother to hear about it on the radio or anything like that, so I grabbed a bottle of scotch and I went out and visited her, and we sat upon the ground and told sad stories of the death of King. And this, I think, turned out to be a happy, very happy one. So I made a poem out of it called My Father the Nightingale. This actually happened. I've got an epigraph to this. F.T. Prince in The Old Age of Michelangelo writes these lines. Dry wood catches the flame. Fire, life in thin, dry air, drawing out the soul at the mouth. He marched the boldest of parades, descending from his death one dark night, 3 days before he died. He wore only his pajama tops, strolling down St. Mary's corridors, singing the ends of his lungs. It was a serenade of an entire man. Those love songs from the musicals, Why Do I Love You, and Ah, Sweet Mystery of Life. The women's hearts were melting as they always had, and no one laughed, although the bagpipe that he blew in making me dangled in the sanitary air. The sister, a merciful angel, crisp and white in her nursing habit, caught him as his concert came to its generous conclusion. She wrapped him in a sheet as though his pipe stood in a final blaze of glory. It did not, but he kept singing as they tied him into bed. Though every inch of skin was shriveled, his music made him ready for the oils, since God had seasoned him as tinder for the night. Just a few. There was a promise that you would hear some newer poems. So, I have some poems that I'm too cheap to spend my money with Hallmark, and besides, I can do better. So I write cards. This is called Birthday Card. If one thing leads to another, far be it from me to abandon the chase. That's how to look at years. Carry them carefully as a woman bears her fervent crown of fluent hair, since all talents must defy and capture sunshine. Birth's a present we can accept just once. Too fresh and wet behind the ears for any notion of what it takes. Ask any mother with her sanity intact, hard as it is constantly attacked. We'll all be stopped dead in our tracks someday, marked on the ground, hoping for an occasional recollection. Getting kindly remembered, that's the trick. You've truly turned it. Cheers. Now I have a series of a few Valentines that I'll read, and then I'll read you my St. Patrick's Day poem. A friend of mine, I sent her a Valentine, and she wrote me a note thanking me, and it was on recycled paper, and she said, write me a poem about recycling the heart. So I did. First off, it's through the mill again, reduced to pulp. It washes around this way a while. Ready or not, it gets flattened out and dries. That just may be the worst part of it all. But then someone begins to roll it out and get it moving down the line. It takes a brand new grain and, trust to luck, a watermark to call its own and wear with pride. It may wait a long time in the warehouse or right away be on the press for all the news it cares to print. On it goes, useful again, again, again.